So as it turns out, I'm not going to say very much at all about the gospel today. Almost no one really believes that that is a parable that originally came from Jesus. And even such like linguistic hints, like that word Hades, that's not a Greek. I mean, that's not a Jewish word. That's a Greek word. It's as odd in a biblical passage as if someone were to speak about nirvana. It just comes from a completely different tradition. So it seems like one of a fairly traditional folk tale, a reversal story. You know, the rich guy gets tormented and the poor guy gets, you know, comforted. As, you know, sort of a story of folk wisdom. And that's about all I'm going to say about it. Where I want to go today is I want to look at this story in Jeremiah, this purchase of the field. And then I want to look a little bit at 1 Timothy that has some pretty powerful things in it about money and contentment and what the purpose of life is. But we're going to start with Jeremiah. And I have long loved this story about the purchase of the field at Anathoth. And to understand why it's significant, you have to understand a little bit about the situation that Jeremiah was in. First of all, he'd been arrested. He had been speaking out against government policies. And he was thought to be disloyal because he was critical. Not that that's ever happened in any other political situation. Thought to be disloyal, and so he was imprisoned. But he did have the right, almost like the right of first refusal, this piece of property in a suburb of Jerusalem. But Jerusalem was under siege by the Babylonian armies. Huge, powerful armies. I think there was no doubt whatsoever about the outcome. Jerusalem was going to fall, and in fact it did fall, and then soon after, the sort of the cream of Jerusalem was carted off to Babylon to go into slavery. But this had not happened yet. But nonetheless, it is like buying a piece of property now in Aleppo or Fallujah. It's buying property in a war zone. It's buying property with a sword hanging over your head. And when I started thinking about it in those terms, buying property with a sword hanging over your head, with almost certain destruction to follow, I go, well, okay, that is certainly reflective of the situation that Jeremiah found himself in. Specific situation, oh, armies at the gate ready to overrun my hometown. When I started thinking about it, I went, well, you know, in a sense, everything we do is conducted sort of with an army at the gates. It's not a physical army, but it's the army of death. And we kind of visited this territory a few weeks ago in Ecclesiastes, where Ecclesiastes is speaking and he's going, well, okay, I get it now. I get it. I work. I've been successful, and I've got this stuff, but I'm going to die. And it's all going to go away, and I'm going to lose control over it. And what is the point? You know, in a sense, Jeremiah and Ecclesiastes are looking at the same situation. Jeremiah's situation is more sort of concretely threatening because there's a literal army at the gates. But in a sense, metaphorically, there's always an army at the gates. And we all have to wrestle with that radical question, what is the point of all of this? And it brought to mind a story from a different tradition. I think it's from the Zen Buddhist tradition. Maybe known to some of you. The story, and there are variants, but it's about a guy, and he's chased by a tiger, or maybe a bunch of tigers, and he's running, and he's barely getting away, and then he comes to the edge of an impossibly high cliff, and he puts himself over the cliff, and he's hanging on to a vine, and below him, it's either a lethal fall, or crocodiles, or more tigers. tigers. So there's tigers above, tigers below, and then he's hanging onto a vine, and he sees mice chewing on the vine. But then, growing in the hillside is one perfect red ripe strawberry. And he plucks it and eats it, and it is so perfect and so good. Again, this is not entirely dissimilar from buying the property with armies at the gates. I've got tigers behind me and tigers in front of me, and the mice are chewing my only support. But there is a strawberry right there to be plucked, right there, a juicy, perfect berry in the heart of life. And for all of us, if we understand what our true situation is, we're going to be a lot closer to that guy with tigers chasing him and tigers awaiting him and our support being gnawed away. It's under those conditions that we will find the sweetness of life or not. Under those conditions, will we pluck the berry that is the sweetness of life? Under those conditions, will we put down the money to buy property, even though we know, like Ecclesiastes knew, that it will go away? And yet, I mean, it's sort of like the burial service, you know, those wonderful words of the commendation that say, you only, it's addressed to God, you only are immortal, creator and maker of humankind, and we are mortal, formed of the earth, and to earth we shall return. For so did you ordain when you created me, saying, dust you are, and to dust you shall return. All of us go down to the dust, yet even at the grave we make our song, alleluia, alleluia, alleluia. Even at the grave we pluck the strawberry and savor the sweetness of life. We cannot control, we cannot hang on to anything. But there is sweetness of life if we but simply have enough trust to let ourselves enjoy it under these rather difficult conditions. I'm going to jump now to 1 Timothy. What does he say? I mean, these are strong words. There is great gain in godliness combined with contentment. For we brought nothing into the world, and we can take nothing out of it. But if we have food and clothing, we will be content with these. Well, the thing I was thinking as I read this word, and it was really the word contentment that just grabbed hold of me. And I thought of how contentment would sound in contemporary American culture. And, I mean, you could almost say contentment equals loser. Content. I hear your new son-in-law is content with where he is. Is that what a father wants to hear of his daughter's new husband? Oh, yeah, he's not ambitious at all. He's just content. Content means complacent. Content means things as they are fine. I'm not going to strive. I'm not going to push. I'm not going to go anywhere. Or you might say, contentment. How much of the energy of our culture, I think of media, is really the systematic cultivation of discontent? Like, the worst thing in the world for the American economy would be an epidemic of contentment. What would we do? My phone is good enough. Everything I have is good enough. You know, the economy would simply grind to a halt in a day. And so contentment, in one sense, that is being advocated by 1 Timothy, is the last thing that we really think about. And, of course, there is a sense in which contentment can actually be complacency, just a sort of self-satisfaction that doesn't really care much about the world. I think contentment, though, is really, I want to put that in terms of what I've been talking about in recent weeks in terms of Sabbath. Contentment is not just, I had a pretty good day, and the contentment that First Timothy is talking about is a radical spiritual place where, again, as we've been talking about, that Sabbath moment, where you simply let the world be just as it is. Just as it is. You're not trying to change anything. That is contentment, where you reach that point where there's not a single part of your life that you're pushing away, saying no to, saying, I can't go through that. You say yes to everything. Life, death, and everything that happens in between. Now that is contentment. And once you sort of experience that moment, then you're in a position to help change the world. It's like there's a type of therapy that I often bring up, dialectical behavior therapy. And at the core of that is a paradox. And the first part of the paradox is, you are perfectly acceptable just as you are. And the second part of the paradox is, and you have to change. And I think that is contentment, the Sabbath. The world is just as it is. And I say yes to the whole thing. And then once I'm there, then the world really has to change. But I don't know if this will make sense, but the words, these cryptic words of Jesus have been kind of echoing through my mind this week. To the one who has, more will be given. To the one who has not, even what you think you have will be taken away. And again, I think this is talking about a kind of contentment. To the one who says yes to his or her own life and all that it includes, that life is going to get richer. But to the one who is dividing and saying yes to this and no to that, and I'll deal with this and I'm going to run away from that, and I simply cannot deal with her, that person is going to miss some fundamental experience of being themselves and being alive. The countercultural thing with 1 Timothy, I mean, I want us to hear when it talks about contentment and it talks about the love of money, I just want us to remember that we live in a culture, and the biblical culture was sort of money hungry too, but we have elevated the love of money to an art form unprecedented in human history. I mean, we celebrate, we love money, we lust after money, we worship money, we have money as the singular touchstone for meaning in the life of a culture. And we have to know how corrosive that is for human happiness. We have to know that we did bring nothing into the world and we take nothing out of it. And what does life look like when we remember that? And what are we really striving for? And what do we really think is the goal of our energy? We're here so that we can look more clearly at the places where we're invited to spend our energy and our time and our money. And then maybe reconsider some of those choices so that we, like the concluding words of our lesson from 1 Timothy, so that we can take hold of life that really is life. Lots of substitutes out there. Lots of things that promise satisfaction that don't deliver. What we're trying to do is take hold of life that really is life.